Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Matthew Jordan, and I'm an instructor at McMaster University and a funk musician. I am joined today by W. Patrick McRae, who is a professor in the History Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is an author of many interesting books about technology and science, mostly in the context of the Cold War in the United States, but also in other places. He's written about telescopes and communities of science and the technologies involved in scientific discovery and the relationship between the Cold War science and the American counterculture. And this today is a book that combines a lot of those interests. The book is called Making Art Work: How Cold War Engineers and Artists Forged a New Creative Culture. Patrick, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks for the invite.
Well, I'd love to start by just talking about the subject of this book, which is collaborations between artists and engineers. You are a historian of science. What led you to seek to write a book that focused so much on the art world?
It was partly personal and partly professional. So the personal part is that when I start looking for new book projects, I try to pick book projects that are going to take me in directions that are basically going into some unfamiliar territory. So when I started the research for this project about 8 years ago, I had a lot of interest in modern art, but I didn't know a great deal about its history. So writing this book was an opportunity to partly for me to learn about the history of a new field. And then from a professional point of view, I was really intrigued by what would happen if you put the histories of art and science and technology in dialogue with each other, because I saw these collaborations between artists and engineers as both historically interesting, but also something that I was aware was happening on campuses all across the United States and Europe. So in some sense, this was exploring a phenomena that I was, seeing on my own campus within my own University of California system.
Yeah, I would love later on to speak about what, art and technology look like in collaboration in the 21st century.
Sure.
But maybe if we hop back kind of 100 years, I would love to kind of set the stage a little bit by understanding the question of like disciplines and fields and who were the type of people engaged in various pursuits. It's obviously a big question, but maybe at the time of World War II, or maybe a bit after the Cold War, the era that you describe here, how should we go about understanding the divide between, scientists, artists, engineers? Were there clear delineations between those fields? And if so, how would they best be understood?
I think there were much more clear delineations between those communities, say in the 1950s and 1960s, than we have now. After World War II, scientists, of course, had enormous social and professional prestige, oftentimes, you know, credited with helping end World War II with the development of things like radar and nuclear weapons and things like that. Engineers always found themselves kind of struggling in the battle to achieve parity in terms of status and professional recognition vis-a-vis that of scientists. And the artist community itself was also in the midst of some fairly profound changes, many of which also reflect what was happening in the engineering community. This emphasis on being more professional, less of a craftsperson, becoming more managerial, the achievement of secure middle-class status was something that both engineers and artists had secured by the 1950s and 1960s. So in many ways, a lot of the things that intrigued me about this project were seeing these parallels between the community of artists and the community of engineers. So that was certainly one of the things that I noticed.
There's very famously, one of the things that you open your book with is a discussion of this idea of the two cultures from the thinker, I don't know what to call him, C.P. Snow, literary person and quasi-scientist C.P. Snow. Was there a sense then, as there is now, of there being, you know, this divide between the literary intellectuals or the art critics, so we can imagine in their, I don't know, turtlenecked sweaters, swishing glasses of wine, talking about the high arts versus the engineers or scientists in their, you know, their thick-rimmed glasses stereotypically and their, I don't know, big textbooks on their computers and abacuses. This is a picture of a stereotype that barely exists, but you get the point I'm getting at. I mean, how accurately, I don't know, does that describe a sense of a two cultures? Was C.P. Snow getting at something real and legitimate in the culture that would be subverted, you know, by collaborations between those two groups?
So, I mean, first of all, C.P. Snow was a chemist who then became a novelist. And, you know, he felt that he was, you know, he was British, and he felt that he was, you know, uniquely positioned to sort of comment on these different intellectual traditions, if you will. But the key thing that I point out in the book is you have C.P. Snow's original ideas, which were very British in their formulation, you know, based on a 1959 speech or lecture that he gives in Cambridge, which then gets, you know, translated into a book, which, you know, makes its way to the United States. But C.P. Snow's original formulation of the two cultures, which itself wasn't terribly original at the time. I mean, other people had commented on these divides for decades prior to that, but, you know, he just happened to get a lot of attention. I think, you know, good timing. But, you know, he was commenting really on this divide that he saw between the literary intellectuals in Britain and scientists. What's interesting is that he chides both communities in Britain for being somewhat ignorant of and hostile to technology and engineering. So that was sort of something that I found you can find in a close reading of C.P. Snow's Two Cultures book, which doesn't oftentimes get commented on. Usually it's just sort of opposing science versus literature. You know, and he was roundly critiqued for making this observation and proposing this sort of binary. But the thing that I found really interesting is once you pull up anchor on C.P. Snow's ideas and ship them off to the United States, they become unmoored from this British context and they take on sort of a new life, if you will. So by the time that you get to the 1960s in the United States, if you were an expert in higher education or something, you could just simply, you know, refer to the two cultures and it would be devoid of its original British context, which was oftentimes, you know, heavily rooted also in class. And it just sort of referred to this divide between these different intellectual traditions. And as I write about in the book, people who were advocating these collaborations between artists and engineers found that with the two cultures idea, that it was a very effective rhetorical idea to deploy to make their case for why art and technology should be brought together. Because just simply by invoking this idea of this binary divide, you know, it's kind of spoke volumes. It did a lot of work for people, I guess, by the time you get to the late 1960s.
Yeah, it's interesting that people were like explicitly invoking that argument in order to justify their own like interdisciplinary or collaborative work.
It'd be sort of like if you were to just use the phrase in the 1960s or 70s, national security. I mean, you didn't really need to unpack what that really meant, because everyone sort of has some sort of assumed meaning. So within the world of higher education, you could refer to the two cultures and people would just sort of nod and go, yes, of course.
Right. I want to turn a little bit to understanding a bit more of the Cold War context for a lot of this story. As many people surely know, obviously during World War II and the years after, there was a massive boom in the development of science and technology, a huge amount of funding from the federal government and the military in the United States went into the development of new technologies and basic science research. Even the notion of basic science research is a product of this time. Huge involvement from governments and all sorts of other bodies. We think of organizations like DARPA and NASA. And anyway, what is the culture, I guess, of engineers in this setting? You know, when we think about places like Bell Labs or the emergence of Silicon Valley, which comes from the development of transistors. Who were the types of people working in these settings? What was their education like, and what was their, or maybe what was their training as engineers, and what was their relationship to, say, these military groups that have been discussing, or just the state apparatus in general?
That's a big question. I'll see if I can tackle that. So, I mean, first of all, the culture of engineering, you know, was changing dramatically in the 1960s. It was, you know, highly professional. People were getting advanced degrees. But it's also important to remember this was an extremely prosperous time. So if you graduated from a university, either with a bachelor's degree in engineering or maybe a higher degree, you had pretty secure employment prospects, and you would be paid fairly well. Obviously, it tended to attract primarily white men, so there was a certain stereotype that went along with that as well, which we're still grappling with today as we try to, you know, make engineering and science more diverse. But I think there were all sorts of stereotypes that went along with it too, that engineers were conformist, that they were organization men, that they weren't terribly creative. And these were stereotypes that I tried to explore in the book and see that, you know, while stereotypes exist for good reasons, there were also lots and lots of examples for how this wasn't the case. And one of the things that I found really most remarkable was looking, for example, at advertisements in magazines for engineers that were aimed to recruit engineers to companies. So rather than depicting the engineer as, you know, the stereotypical organization man, oftentimes these advertisements presented the world of engineering at a particular company as a place where they could exercise creativity, they could be nonconformist, they could be individuals, and they didn't necessarily just have to become the, you know, stereotypical man in a gray flannel suit. The funding that you mentioned is also really critical. You know, as I said, this was a very prosperous time for lots of American companies. But it's also important to remember there was sort of a rising tide floats all boats. Not only are these companies and institutions doing science and engineering becoming prosperous, but the world associated with the artist was also becoming more prosperous. I mean, the National Endowment for the Arts was established by Lyndon Johnson in 1965. So you have the federal government not getting involved just with the funding of science and engineering, but also making an investment in the funding of the arts and humanities. It was all sort of part of Johnson's, you know, vision for a great society. And then with this corporate wealth that was being accumulated, you also had companies like Bell Labs being willing to support the arts, you know, sometimes directly by sponsoring exhibitions, but also by providing opportunities for artists to do residences. And this was certainly something that was done quite extensively at Bell Labs, which in my book emerges as sort of one of the main companies that I spent some time looking at. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's excellent. And so I just, one thing I really want to kind of get out with these first few questions is tease apart just how different, you know, the world of, you know, Cold War engineering is from the world of the artists as we might understand them. But maybe we can speak about a couple more similarities before we get into kind of this collaborative art and technology movement of the Cold War 60s and 70s that you profile. You know, when we talk about art and technology, some might ask, well, has technology and art not always been, you know, deeply collaborative? Have there not always been, I don't know, manufacturers and glass blowers and materials people? And I forget, there's a name of a book that you mentioned early in your book that you cite an author having written a book about all the other people involved in the art world who are not the artists themselves, many of whom I would say are involved in some kind of technology. They're not 1960s Bell Labs engineers, but is there not already, a great deal of overlap between the world of technology and the world of art? And so what makes the period that you profile specifically different?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's clearly, I mean, obviously one of the things that engineers and artists have in common is they both work with stuff. I mean, one of the fundamental activities of being an engineer is design. You have to design, you know, whatever it is you're going to build, make, whatever, there's a design that's involved there. Similar with artists. And, you know, again, it sounds like a glib observation, but both artists and engineers manipulate the material world. So, I mean, this is one of the distinctions that I make in the book of looking at art and technology versus art and science, which oftentimes the science and technology become conflated, but they are very different activities. They are different forms of knowledge and different ways of knowing and working with the world. So clearly, yes, there's lots of, centuries worth of examples of artists being involved with technology. The thing that makes the time period that I focus on in the book different is that you begin to see the emergence of large-scale formal collaborations that are well-funded and well-organized emerging in the 1960s to bring groups of engineers and groups of artists together to make art. So this separates these activities are different from things you might have seen early on, where maybe you have a one-on-one collaboration between an artist and an engineer. So that's sort of a marked quantum leap, if you will, that happens at this time period, is sort of the scale and scope of these collaborations in terms of their size, in terms of the cost that's associated with them. So that's something that really makes them quite different. Mm-hmm.
So I guess the final thing kind of setting the stage here is that, the thing that this book really illustrated for me that I didn't quite realize was that there was a thing, you know, in the 1960s, a concerted mm-hmm. effort on the part of many artists and many technologists, engineers, to create something called the art and technology movement, you know, exemplified by events like experiments in art and technology presentations, their curations, their events, along with many like institutes, many research programs, many university programs that originated in this time period in order to like explicitly, you know, create a movement centered around art and technology. Mm-hmm. But that is not really remembered anymore. People don't think about, you know, people may think that there, you know, exists university programs where the emphasis is on, I don't know, like humanistic design or art and technology or whatever it is. But I think a lot of people don't really realize that there was this concern, like this specific thing that you profile that I realize that we haven't actually spoken about explicitly. Was that a surprise to you? How did you, I guess, come across this specific movement? And what is it like to kind of unearth, a type of like social movement or group of people that aren't really studied or explored that much in the broader culture?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one thing to think about is, you know, before I became a historian, I was an engineer. So, I mean, it's, I guess I'm sort of have my feet or had my feet at one point on these different sides of this two cultures thing. But just before I get specifically to what you asked, I did kind of want to just remind listeners, it's important to remember also that the technologies that artists wanted to work with in the 1960s, for example, oftentimes were unavailable to them. So things like digital computers and other electronic devices, lasers, working with holography, things like that. These are things now that we take as technologies that are fairly domesticated for us in the sense that they're readily available and inexpensive for us. But if you were an artist in the 1960s and you wanted to break away from the grip of abstract expressionism or whatever and begin to experiment with new media or new tools, oftentimes the cost and complexity of these new technologies were such that you would be obliged to find an engineer or a group of engineers to work with simply to experiment with these, is that the nature of the technology was such, the cost, the sophistication, and simply getting access to these things was such that you had to partner with a group of engineers. In terms of what sort of brought this movement together, again, I think it was, you know, tied to the desire of artists to experiment and work with new technologies, and also on the part of engineers, a community of engineers. Again, we're not talking about the entire community of engineers across the globe, but enough of them, several thousand, who were intrigued with ideas about creativity and were also eager to, for lack of a better phrase, demonstrate that engineers were people too. Again, to get away from this idea of the engineer as just this sort of corporate drone, but by partnering with artists, this was a way, if you will, to humanize engineering in some ways. And this also, again, was something that corporate managers and business executives sought to encourage, because at a time when engineers had lots of job prospects available to them, this was one way to keep engineers at their companies happy, to keep them intellectually satisfied, and to prevent them from moving on to another company where they might have more chance to experiment in these areas.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing up that point about the inaccessibility of a lot of these technologies to the artists who were working at this time, right? I know that nowadays when I enter a modern art museum and see a piece that's, you know, I don't know, a closed circuit television, like with a bunch of static on some sort of screen, you kind of look at that and think, okay, but why is that art in some ways? But when you go back and realize, well, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, this kind of technology, you know, was actually very sophisticated and very creative. And a lot of the things that you profile, I encourage the listeners to like actively Google names and pieces as we bring them up. Because using, you know, digital tools in novel ways and using, I don't know, lasers and new audio techniques, this was really, really sophisticated stuff. And it was far more than maybe this stereotyped example that maybe some people have in their heads walking through museums of just like, I don't know, someone plugged in a TV backwards and now somehow that's art.
Yeah,
because it's very easy to caricature it in that way.
I mean, just to go with the one example you mentioned, you know, the laser. I mean, today you can go online and buy a laser for $5, have it delivered to your house the next day, and be, you know, playing with your cat, you know, within 10 minutes. But, you know, the laser was invented in the early 1960s. Buying one, you know, costs several tens of thousands of dollars. These were large, complex, really sophisticated sorts of things to do. So if you were a sculptor, for example, one of the people I write about in the book is a Washington, D.C.-based artist named Rockne Krebs, who was interested in using laser light to make sculptures, the idea being that the laser beams would delineate the three-dimensional outline of a sculpture. And this is something he began to do in the late 1960s, working with working with engineers and technicians to help him realize this particular vision. If you would go into an art gallery and see one of his laser light sculptures in, say, 1969, for most people, this probably was the very first time they ever saw a laser. you know, this is before Star Wars and lightsabers and all sort of the popularization of this particular technology. So for some people, this was a chance literally to see this new electronic medium that was being presented to them, coupled with the fact that these oftentimes were very ephemeral works of art. I mean, if you make a sculpture using laser light and then you turn off the power source, what is left? You've got some drawings and some memories, and that's really about it, which also then, of course, posed a challenge for museum directors and gallery owners and curators. I mean, how do you curate these ephemeral works of art, which I know is something that curators and museum people who work with new media art today, are still grappling with, is sort of the ephemerality, of these objects, so to speak.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's really something that, I don't know, I mean, in some ways it's not a solved problem, but it's really easy to take for granted how different, you know, a lot of museums are today, and probably how much more flexible the curators are, because we're used to a lot of weirdness, you know, a lot of integration of technology and lights and video and wireless, yeah. You know, and that kind of immersive experience. But it's easy to forget that, you know, that had to be invented.
I mean, I think that's kind of one of the takeaway points that I try to leave the reader with in the book, is that these categories of art and technology and artists and engineers are dynamic categories. They're historically contingent. They change over time. So like you said, you can go into the Museum of Modern Art at some point and see these things and be like, okay, this is video art, or this is a light and sound sort of thing. But in 1965, this would have been an entirely different context for these pieces, as members of the art world struggled with the question of trying to clarify the question, you know, is this art? And of course, you know, that goes all the way back to, you know, Marcel Duchamp, you know, hanging a snow shovel on the wall and calling it that art, you know, the art of the ready-made. And, you know, for many of the people that I write about in the book, I mean, they oftentimes would, you know, trace their lineage back to Dada and Duchamp, and sort of, you know, try to blow up those questions about, you know, what is art and what isn't art and what counts. And also who gets to be an artist, who counts as an artist.
I'd like to turn to the organization that I hope you would agree is kind of the focal point of a lot of this book, which is called Experiments in Art and Technology. Mm-hmm. I would assume that most listeners have not heard of this group before. I certainly had not. Yeah, I'm wondering if you could describe its founding, maybe Billy Kluver, the people, Robert Rauschenberg, the people who were involved in creating this organization, and what its purpose was.
Okay, well, the figure most associated with this group, Experiments in Art and Technology, which was based in New York City and sort of had its heyday from about 1966 through 1971. The person most associated with it is an engineer named Billy Kluver. Billy Kluver grew up in Sweden. He trained there as an engineer, but he was also a huge fan of experimental cinema. And he became very good friends with some artists and other people in Sweden who later went on to have prominent roles in contemporary art in the 1960s and 1970s. Kluver moves to the United States in 1954 to go to graduate school at Berkeley, where he gets his PhD in electrical engineering, graduates in 1959, and he joins Bell Labs, which at that point was sort of the world's preeminent industrial laboratory. So, you know, he still has maintained this interest in the avant-garde and film and art and literature. And he's at Bell Labs, which is in northern New Jersey. And he literally finds himself astride these two cultures, working in Bell Labs for his day job as a laser physicist and spending his evenings and weekends frequenting Manhattan lofts and Greenwich Village galleries and places like that. In 1966, with the artists Robert Rauschenberg and Robert Whitman and another engineer at Bell Labs named Fred Waldhauer, they start a nonprofit organization that they call Experiments in Art and Technology, or EAT. And for the next 5 years, EAT becomes one of the major players, especially in the United States, but also active overseas in instigating these formal collaborations between engineers and artists. And the whole focus of the organization was not so much on the kind of art that was being made. And Kluver and his colleagues were quite explicit about this. They were much less concerned with the product. What they were concerned about was the collaborative process. For many of them, this process of how the art was made was the interesting aspect of it. So we can think about it, I suppose, as a form of sociological experimentation as well.
Yeah. And so one of the key events or series of shows that the Experiments in Art and Technology, do you say EAT? I mean, the acronym is EAT. Is that how they called it?
They don't. It's just EAT. I've talked to people who were involved with it. I'm like, you know, should I just call it EAT? And they would always kind of wrinkle their nose and be like, no, we never called it that. It was just simply EAT.
Good to know. Yeah, I mean the there was this series of events, nine evenings, theater and engineering, a series of of performance art pieces. I guess it's so hard to describe. I'm wondering if you have any favorites in terms of the types of work that they did, or the pieces that they experimented with, or just any like particularly interesting uses of technology that you found interesting or surprising.
Well, I mean, Experiments in Art and Technology eventually grew to have some 4,000 members, but it really got its, it was catalyzed by this event in New York City in October of 1966 called Nine Evenings, Theater and Engineering, lasted for nine evenings, but it brought together about 10 artists, Robert Rauschenberg, Robert Whitman, Lucinda Child, Yvonne Rainer, John Cage, excuse me. Along with a whole bunch of engineers from Bell Laboratories. And together they put on nine evenings worth of performances. Thousands of people showed up at the Armory in New York City to see this. And it really was a true collaboration between these artists and engineers. It was very expensive. The total cost of these was well over $100,000. So, you know, that's about $1 million in today's money. Art critics were confounded by this. The leading art critic for the New York Times wrote, God bless American art, but God help American science, because a lot of the performances did not come off as planned. There were lots of technical glitches and things like that that didn't work. But again, that was sort of the point. Kluver and his colleagues wanted to show, in some ways, a critique of technology that it wasn't perfect, that you couldn't just expect miracles from it, that you needed to do work to make art work. And, in some ways that was part of the subversive message of these, was that when the technology didn't work, this was a bit of a commentary on the nature of modern technology itself. EAT went on to foster, you know, hundreds of collaborations throughout the late 1960s, early 1970s, but it became increasingly involved in these large-scale corporate-funded art and technology spectacles. So in the book, one of the main ones that I focus on is the Pepsi Pavilion, which the Pepsi soft drink company hired EAT to do in conjunction with the Expo 70 that was held in Osaka, Japan in 1970. So this was the first World's Fair that was held in Asia. So for, that was a big deal, especially in the wake after the Second World War. This was sort of a chance for Japan to demonstrate that it had, recovered, and it was now, part of this larger system.
Hmm. Yeah, I want to hold on that Osaka World Fair Pavilion for a second, because I guess the Pepsi Pavilion. I mean, it's just cool, frankly. It's got these jutting pyramidal structures. I mean, it's very difficult to describe. What was and then in the inside, there's such clever use of mirrors and audio devices and wireless technologies. I guess, what was the goal of this structure, of this performance? What was EAT trying to convey? What were they trying to prove, maybe, to the rest of the art world or the rest of the engineering world with this sculpture and performance?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it really opens up the real issue that EAT found itself with. Was, they were hired by Pepsi, and Pepsi eventually paid them about $1.2 million. So again, that's about $12 million in today's money. So this was a very expensive undertaking. I mean, in the book, I describe it as sort of the art world's version of big science. Instead of a large particle accelerator or something like that, you had the Pepsi Pavilion. But the issue became that for Pepsi, this was simply a way of demonstrating their presence at the World's Fair. IBM and one other company, these were the only three American companies that had their own structures at the fair. So this was very visible publicity for Pepsi, and that's sort of how they envisioned it. The members of EAT, and eventually the project grew to encompass hundreds of engineers, artists, technicians, and other people working on it to make the Pepsi Pavilion come to life. They really saw it as this choose-your-own-adventure multimedia environment. I mean, so right. The traditional World's Fair Pavilion is, you march in with tens of thousands of other people and you just go from exhibit to exhibit and just see what's there. And they wanted to create this space where you could go inside this specially engineered and designed building and kind of have your own sound and visual experience. And you could stay in there as long as you wanted, and you could sort of create your own aesthetic visual experience, if you will, instead of sort of having it imposed upon you by whatever national pavilion or corporate pavilion that you visited. So the people of EAT very much saw it as a multimedia experiment and laboratory, whereas, Pepsi obviously saw it as a branding opportunity. And, at the time, Pepsi was behind Coca-Cola in sales, and it was really trying to expand its global presence and to have such a prominent place in Japan. This was seen as a chance to really reach into the Asian market. So the Pepsi executives and the people involved with EAT had very orthogonal views as to what this meant, which eventually brought them into considerable conflict.
Maybe we could turn to another set of artists or practices or groups.
Sure.
I want to try to cover many different types of people. So we've spoken about Billy Kluver and Robert Rauschenberg. I'm wondering if you could maybe say some words about another person, probably whom most people have not heard about before, but Maurice Tuchman. I don't know if I'm saying that name correctly.
No, that's right. So in the book, I kind of based the book around four individuals, all of whom had different strategies for pursuing art and technology. One of them is a American engineer turned artist named Frank Molina. Another person is a Hungarian-born artist named Georgi Kepes, who's involved with a particular project at MIT. Maurice Tuchman was a curator of modern art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And like Billy Kluver, like these other individuals that I mentioned, he had a vision for bringing art and technology together. But his strategy that he pursued was by starting a 5-year program at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, or LACMA, that would link artists to industry, and the outcome of that would be a major exhibition. It gets complicated because the LACMA effort also exhibited at Osaka in 1970, but the main focus of this was an exhibit that happened in Los Angeles in 1971. But Tuckman was really keen to bring artists and industry together, less so about bringing artists and engineers together. So he was sort of operating from a different strategy and was much more focused on the artists and the artists' needs, as opposed to Billy Kluver, who tended to see parity between the artists and engineers in terms of their own individual creativity. So Tuckman was really about linking artists with major companies like IBM and Lockheed and TRW, lots of companies that had deep ties to the military-industrial complex, which became an issue whenever the show debuted in 1971. But this was his particular strategy and sort of a way of showcasing what he felt was the futuristic nature of Los Angeles. And one way of highlighting that was by linking artists with high technology.
Yeah, I guess one thing that's a bit of a surprise here is, you know, I don't associate artists with being the most content with the military industrial complex. Like you said, that might have been a source of conflict. Was that an issue? Was there, you know, how did, I don't know, the companies and technologies that were most integrated with, say, the development of nuclear weapons or the use of computing in warfare, integrate with this, I don't know, culture of art that was at the height of, say, the anti-Vietnam movement?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the interesting things that I describe in the book is that, you know, when Tuckman starts this initiative in 66, 67, he was really surprised by the fact that he got very, very little pushback from the artists. And, you know, by the time the program ended, something like 70, 75 different artists were involved with this. So that this was not just a small group of artists. But in that intervening period between when he starts the program and when the exhibition happens in 1971, of course, world events had changed in very, very dramatic ways. And, you know, it's an entirely different world that he finds himself sort of navigating in 1971. And he and the museum and the artists who are involved begin to take a lot of criticism for compromising themselves, as art critics said, you know, ethically, by collaborating with engineers, by using military-derived technology and accepting corporate patronage. But as Tuckman himself writes in the show's catalog, what surprised him was how little resistance he got at the beginning. He makes the offhanded comment that it was sort of like Trotsky writing for the Hearst publishing empire, that you'd think there would be a disjuncture, but the artists were not too discomfited by it initially. That did change over time, as the sculptor Richard Serra said in 1971, critiquing Tuckman's show. He wrote to Tuckman himself that said, technology, I'm quoting here, was technology was what we do to the Black Panthers and the Vietnamese under the guise of advancement of a materialistic theology.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, that's not mincing words there. And it's clear that by the time you get to that level of discourse, we're not talking anymore about the mismatch between art and technology, that the critiques had really gone up a level and were directed much more at like sort of deeper systemic problems in society itself. And Tuckman's show was also roundly criticized for not having any people of color associated with it, and also no women artists. And as I write about in the book, you know, this actually became one of the catalysts for a very prominent women artists movement in Los Angeles. They looked at this show and they looked at the representation or lack of representation of women artists in major museums and kind of launched their own guerrilla movement against this sort of thing and began to protest outside the museum. And, you know, again, this was something that, you know, it might have not been okay, but maybe not commented on in 1965 to have a major show with no women. But by 1971, that was just simply not acceptable. So really the landscape, if you will, had sort of changed under under Tuckman's feet.
Yeah, that's interesting. And obviously the art world and the world of technology or engineering both, you know, stereotypically have, rightly have, you know, have not been the most welcoming places to, you know, people of color, to women in general. So it's interesting to see how, you know, how emphatic that was, especially in an era of such, you know, dramatic social upheaval, social change, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's interesting that those, you know, broader societal forces were, of course, like reflected in that world.
I just want to say one comment too, that one of the things that I did find very interesting in the book is that while oftentimes women were shut out from traditional forms of artistic expression like painting, and I shouldn't say shut out, but they were much less visible. I mean, now, of course, you have lots of exhibitions and shows and books written about women artists from this time. They were sort of coming out from the shadow of the male artists at the time. But one of the things I found interesting was that these new technologies, because they were so novel and had much less baggage associated with them, you did see oftentimes lots of women, more than you might expect, experimenting with this. So one of the people I write about in the book is an artist by the name of Barbara Smith, who in the 1960s begins to experiment with photocopiers as a way of making new forms of visual art. And one of the things I write about is, well, you know, no one else was doing this. It was just sort of a wide open field, generally speaking, and it kind of provided an opportunity for women who maybe didn't feel as welcome working in painting or traditional forms of sculpture or whatever to go into these other areas where there was just less of a male presence, so to speak.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I want to talk now a bit more about the kind of institutions that have lasted a bit longer, which is some of the university bodies. You spoke quite a bit in the book about CAVS. I don't know if they call it CAVS or if they call it CAVS, like EAT,
yeah.
The Center for Advanced Visual Studies at MIT. I know for a fact they call that MIT and not MIT, which is one of very many university centers like that is based on studying art and technology and, you know, has artists in residence and research programs and education. That was founded by Georgi Kepes, who is the third of the four people that you mentioned when you were speaking about the four main people you profile in the book. I guess my question is, generally, we can talk about CAVS specifically, but what was the role of the university?
One of the things to think about is that if you were, in the book, I focus a lot on MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, because, you know, it is an elite engineering institution. And one of the major concerns that MIT's leaders had in the 50s and 60s was the nature of the engineering curriculum. They wanted to make sure that they were producing, you know, well-rounded students. And one of the ways that they tried to address this was by humanizing the engineering curriculum by bringing the humanities and visual arts into it. Georgi Kepes was a Hungarian-born artist with ties to the German Bauhaus. He had been hired by MIT in 1946. And then two decades later, in the mid-1960s, he establishes a center called the Center for Advanced Visual Studies, or CAVS, with the idea that it would, through fellowships, foster collaboration between artists and MIT's engineers and scientists. It had some successes, but it never really quite found a comfortable fit within MIT. But from CAVS, we get the seeds for which emerge today's media lab at MIT, which, you know, in the last couple of years has been in the news for a different set of reasons. But the media laboratory was established in the mid-1980s as a way of promoting and experimenting and with new media technologies explicitly in close cooperation and collaboration with large companies. But just to sort of go back to your initial statement, when you asked your question, Matthew, is one of the things that I was interested in when I was writing, starting to write this book and think about it, was, you know, the University of California, where I'm based, has 10 campuses. As I look across those 10 campuses, I think there are something like 9 or 10 degree-granting programs, centers, or institutes that all exist within just the University of California to foster collaboration between art and technology, artists and engineers, and science and scientists. So, you know, this is sort of one of the legacies, I think, that comes out of this first wave of art and technology activity is the institutionalization of art and technology within a university setting, you know, which is something I don't think people necessarily anticipated in the 1960s, but that is one of the things that that has come out of that. You know, the Media Lab is a very, very different creature than what Georgie Kepisch created in the mid-1960s. You know, the basis of the Media Lab was much more on artful technology, I guess, rather than technological art. The emphasis there was much more on design and technology from an aesthetic sensibility than it was on making works of art. In fact, the head of the Media Lab, Nicholas Negroponte, was quite explicit whenever he pitched the Media Laboratory to MIT's administrators, you know, that he was not going to be creating a fine arts program, that this was something that would have close ties with business and with corporations and would be profitable and self-supporting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And as we, as we round out, as I feel like whenever I speak with a historian, as soon as I start speaking too much about the present, I feel like we're coming to a close. You know, we're drawing out the lessons from the past, I suppose. But I mean, what is the role, I guess, in the 21st century? We mentioned this at the very beginning. Of institutions like the MIT Media Lab or any of the many groups in the University of California system that you're mentioning, or in California in general. Obviously, LA is a key center, as is San Francisco in the book that you profile. Is this, you know, what the art and technology movement is today? Is there something that we even recognize as the art and technology movement, or is the legacy of you know, all the things we've been talking about from the 60s, these university kind of organizations?
I mean, I think the university organizations that I've spoken of have certainly acquired a longevity, and they have an institutional support in a way that something like EAT was never able to achieve. I mean, universities are long-lived institutions, so they do have that going for them. One of the things that I emphasize in the book is that this interest in art and technology comes in waves. You know, we have this wave in the 1960s, we have this wave that begins to start in the mid-1980s and then really picks up speed with the dot-com era and the robust financial resources that were available in the 1990s. That second wave kind of ends, if you will, around you know, March of 2000 when the dot-com boom
right.
And I think we're in the middle of a third wave right now. We have these efforts to bring art into science, technology, engineering, and math education, STEM education. I mean, this is referred to as a effort to do a STEM to STEAM, if you will. I think that certainly reflects the economic circumstances that universities and humanities find themselves in now. After the Great Recession of 2009, humanities programs, you know, are slowly in the process of recovering, although this past year has certainly dealt them a setback. And in many ways, this effort to do STEM to STEAM, I think, from the arts and humanities reflects not a sense of economic prosperity that animated this first wave in the 1960s, but rather reflects a certain economic precariousness. And I do think that this moment that we are in right now, you know, obviously reflects our economic circumstances and also reflects the changing nature that art and technology, you know, have experienced in this 50-year period.
Is there any sense in which, you know, the melding of art and technology simply comes in the form of, I don't know, the number of artists in residence at technology companies, the number of UX designers, graphic designers, just the really deep integration between art and technology, a person like, I don't know, Steve Jobs, who was so motivated by aesthetic principles in that design. And then to this day, like, you know, apps are ultimately, you know, colorful drawings with very specific parameters that are meticulously designed by basically professional artists who happen to be working in a medium, you know, code or graphic design that is just not really recognizable, you know, quite different than the medium of canvas. Is there any sense in which that is, you know, how we should understand art and technology today?
I think there's a lot of similarities there, but I guess one of the things that I see as different is what the motivation is for companies like Facebook or Autodesk to have artist-in-residence programs. I mean, Bell Laboratories in the 60s provided an environment for artists. I think, you know, this is going to sound kind of naive, but I think in many ways because they believed it was a good thing to do. That this was a way of exposing their engineers to different forms of creativity. And, you know, from a more bottom line perspective, AT&T, which was Bell Labs' parent company, I mean, it was hugely profitable. It could afford to do this. You know, this was not a big stretch for them. You know, I sort of wonder, you know, what are the motivations for companies that are, you know, based in the San Francisco area, for example, to do this? I mean, are they really supporting art and artists, or are they hoping to get some sort of commercial product, some sort of commercial innovation out of it? And I guess I see that as a distinction between what we have happening now and these earlier eras, is sort of what are the motivations and what is the position of the artist vis-a-vis that of the company. In terms of what they are expected to produce and how they are being supported. And again, I think this reminds us that art and technology are not static categories. They are evolving cultural enterprises, and artists' relationship with the market and with commerce is very, very different now than it was 50 or 60 years ago. But I do think there are some common points between them.
Right. Yeah, that's great, and I think is a nice place to draw us to a close. In conclusion, do you have any, I don't know, final thoughts? I mean, in terms of this book, if there's one thing that you could impart upon the readers or the listeners in this case about art and technology and interdisciplinarity and collaboration, I guess what is sure. the overarching take-home message, I suppose?
I think the take-home message that I would like to leave listeners and potential readers with is that what art and technology have in common with one another is their capacity to show us new things and to surprise us. And as we look at these different waves of enthusiasm for art and technology, we see shifting relationships between them and their connections with corporations and the public and the art world. But ultimately, this is all about how engineers as well as artists presented their expertise and displayed their creativity. And one of the ways that they did this was by making new creative cultures and by making artwork.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been a discussion about the book, aptly inserted at the end there. Very good product placement. Making Artwork: How Cold War Engineers and Artists Forged a New Creative Culture. If you are interested in art and technology, the Cold War, science, history, anecdotes, pictures, this is the book for you. Patrick McRae, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Matthew.